podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show with accomplished chess players, authors, personalities, and adult improvers where they discuss their lives, their careers, and share tips about how to improve at chess. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. So without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We are joined by a friend of the pod, a return guest. He is one of the top players in the Netherlands, has been a regular member of the Dutch Olympiad team since 2006, winner of the 2015 Reykjavik Open, and a highly respected opening theoretician who's worked with former FIDE world champion Veselin Topalov and currently works with perennial top 10 player Grandmaster Anish Giri. He's also a Chessable author, one of the most popular Chessable courses of all time. I'm one of the purchasers, the lifetime repertoires, Carol Kahn, among other courses. And our guest, Erwin Lamy, has been sharing his thoughts about the World Championship on Twitter, and I have greatly enjoyed it. So I wanted to hear more of them. And luckily, he is willing to accommodate us and reflect more on the World Championship and also talk about his own career. He'll be playing in Tata Steel, the Challengers section, coming in January. Of course, that is the landmark tournament in his native, the Netherlands. So without further ado, let's welcome Grandmaster Erwin Lamy. Sorry, Erwin, back to the show.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me again.
Sure. Sorry for the mispronunciation there. So Erwin, as we were saying before we hit record, I personally am not tired of talking about the World Championship. I don't think you're tired of opining on it. So apologies to any guests who are, but I'm very eager to hear your perspective about the match generally. You had some prescient predictions on Twitter about what openings would occur, but let's dial back and sort of, since we didn't have you on the record before the match, what were your expectations for the match going in, Erwin?
Well, I think, first of all, I mean, since I had no stake in this match, I'm not, as you know, I'm not working with Magnus or with Nepo. So I'm just looking at it like any other fan, I think. So I was just greatly looking forward to this match. And I did think that Carlsen would be a big favorite. But given the fact that he had, well, considerable trouble winning those matches against Caruana and Kariakin, I thought that could get, again, very close, very tense. Basically what we saw in the first six games, I should say. Yeah, and after that, well, we'll get to talk about what unfolded after that, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, we will for sure. And from an opening perspective, Erwin, again, you worked with Grandmaster Veselin Topalov and were on his World Championship team in 2010. So that may have impacted the accuracy of your predictions. What were you expecting stylistically from both players? And were you surprised by what transpired? Especially, I think Nepo being so solid was not tipped by everyone.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, the approach by both. But first of all, I should say that when I was working with Veselin for his match with Topalov, that was 2010, and the changes that chess has undergone since that time, it's immense. So the preparation, the engines especially, they've improved so strongly. Preparation is much deeper than 2010. So that is the first point to make. And then to the strategy of the both players, I think that Nepo really tried to close things down with black in a very forceful manner. You could see that in the Catalan game, for instance, where he played b5, which is a very direct way of playing, trying to basically close the game down as fast as possible. The Petrov is basically the opening to close the game down as fast as possible as well. While Magnus was left a little bit more room for play, I would say. He was, of course, also playing solid systems. So Marshall is very correct opening, solid opening. But within the Marshall, he tried to slightly deviate, play slightly different, even you could say slightly offbeat ways of playing. His move Rook B8, for example, with which he countered the A4 anti-Marshall, was not that popular before the match. I think it will gain enormously in popularity now. But before the match, after A4, the main move was either Bishop B7 or B4, and Magnus deviated to Rook B8. So he slightly tried to get his opponent into different in a different territory, leaving room for play, let's say. Well, I think that, as I said, Nepo, he just tried to close the game down with black and tried to press with white in this anti-martial.
Yeah, and I've seen, of course, given that we know the results of the match now, it's natural that people are going to be looking for ways to suggest things Nepo could have done differently. And I have seen some people suggest that Nepo, being known as such a dynamic and creative player, perhaps he shouldn't have played sort of in like a Karjakin style as black. Do you have an opinion on that? Is it just too easy to say that after the fact?
It is, right? It is. I mean, right now, everybody, it's very easy to comment now on Nepo's strategy. But I think if you look at the first six games, he was doing completely fine. I mean, in the Catalan, for instance, which is an opening, let's say stylistically, we wouldn't immediately place a Nepo in the Catalan section. He's a Grünfeld player by nature. He's a Neidorf player against E4. But at the same time, he has been expanding his repertoire somewhat. I mean, in the candidates, we saw him playing French already. He played the Petrov in the candidates as well. So he has expanded his repertoire quite a lot. So it's hard to say. I mean, in hindsight, yes, he lost game six, and then you can make all these assumptions. But I think he was doing fine, actually, opening-wise. And I think he also understood the openings that he was playing. It's not like he is, he's a real top player. He's there for a reason. He can play various openings, various types of positions. For instance, the game, the Catalan, the second game, where Nepo got surprised with the move knight e5.
Yeah,
I thought he handled that game extremely well. I mean, he really managed to find, in a very difficult, complicated position, he found a way of playing that that game, and he got even the better position, even you could say arguably a winning position. So I'm not convinced that had he gone for the Grünfeld or the Neidorf, that would have significantly changed things. I'm sure that Magnus and his team were also prepared for that. Obviously, they would have tried to hit him there with some interesting ideas that they undoubtedly had been working on for months. So it's hard to say. In hindsight, we can say that, for example, for Karjakin, the same strategy worked better. I think Karjakin said something along those lines as well, that his positional style perhaps suited that strategy better. But I'm really not so sure. If you look at the first six games, Nepo looked fine. And I think it was more a matter of losing that sixth game and the way he dealt with it, or at least the way it looks to everyone. We were not there, but it looked to everyone not being part of the teams, let's say not being close to the players, that something psychologically happened there that just prevented him from coming even close to his normal level after that game six loss.
Yeah, and of course, that's been a topic of much discussion. You know, how much time Nepo spent away from the board was uncharacteristic. I mean, people, again, had sort of touted the possibility going into the match that he would make some, that he has a tendency to rush moves, and that seemed to bite him once or twice. Do you have any theories on what was going on in his head? I mean, once the epic game six didn't go his direction?
Yeah, it's on the topic of him moving fast, that's also something that brought him to the match, of course. He is someone, and I think Magnus even has gone on record saying that even if you beat Nepo, you still don't get any pressure from the game because you feel like you're constantly under pressure.
Right.
So he is constantly banging out this move. And I played myself against Nepo, and of course I'm not in his league at all. But I've experienced the enormous speed with which he's playing. It puts enormous pressure. And even though he may sometimes, as a result, not play the best move, he's able to that pressure that he is constantly applying. It's really hard to deal with. Those mistakes that he made, those blunders that he made. I'm not sure it was because of moving. I thought actually that in this match he was playing relatively calm. We haven't seen this kind of games where he had more than 2 hours on the clock, etc., which is very usual for him. It's very hard to say. What brought him into the match is quick play, putting pressure on the opponent. But it's hard to say just how that backfired in the match, because it's also one of his main strengths.
Yeah, and the blunders were of slightly different characteristic. I mean, I feel like, there's really three major blunders in the games that came after game six. There was the one where he allowed his bishop to be trapped, the one with queen a3 check, which was, you know, losing a pawn to a double attack, and then the one in the final game allowing the queen to come into g4. And to me, the two first blunders were of a similar character. They looked like they could have been somewhat impulsive moves where he just, you know, didn't do his due diligence, or maybe just his head wasn't in the right place and he couldn't spot them. But then the last blunder to me was of a different character. He thought for 9 minutes on that move, and it's the kind of move where danger signs are flashing going into it, you know? So he was clearly concretely calculating and just missed something. I mean, obviously this is an audio only podcast, so we can only go into too much detail, but do you have any theories on what happened there on the last blunder in particular, Erwin?
I've seen the interview with him where he says he simply missed the move queen takes g4.
Yeah,
I mean, he only considered black taking the pawn on f2, and for the listeners it's maybe hard to envision, but essentially he just missed black taking a pawn with check. It's the definition of a blunder. Sometimes it's just hard to explain, but I think in this case it's just the match was essentially over, and this was just they could also have drawn two more games. It would have also been, I mean, for me, after game after the second loss, the match was over for me. And what I also found somewhat disappointing, I think, if you speak about the blunder queen a3 check, where he lost the a7 pawn, he could still have defended very well. I mean, after queen a3 check, black could have played queen d6, and after taking the pawn on a7, black could go on g5. And once again, I will not go into too much detail, but that is still a pretty difficult position to crack for white. And in the game he just went down very fast. So it shows that he was just not in the right frame of mind, I believe, after that loss in game six. And I think that is the main issue, I think, for him this match. At least from the outside, it looked like he was just not prepared for being down in the match. Or so it seemed, at least.
Yeah, I mean, it's the sort of thing you can visualize all you want, but until it happens, it's a different ball game. And as I've mentioned before on the podcast, it was, I mean, Magnus in interviews before the match said he was curious to see how Nepo would react if he fell behind. But I don't want to gloss over Magnus's accomplishment. I feel like it's, you know, the Nepo sort of takes the headlines just because of the way the match played out. But Erwin, what struck you about Magnus's play in this match?
Yeah, of course, Magnus, he pushed him there, obviously. So there's a clear reason why somebody cracks. It's Magnus just did what he does very well with black. He played the marshal, in this case, anti-marshal, obviously, because the real marshal is no longer really played these days. Top players have sort of given up on taking the pawn. So with black, he just tried to be solid, as I said, slowly equalize. And with white, he was trying to put pressure. And he was not afraid to drag the games out. He was also not afraid to leave some play in the position, which is also a sign of strength, obviously. And to be honest, I was never fearing that he would lose with the black pieces. Those marshals... I know there was this moment where Nepo could have played c4 in one of those anti-martial games, and he would have gotten a clear advantage. But even there, it's still a long way before it's actually winning. And Magnus is very good in those positions. He plays them very well, and it's simply very hard to beat him. Even if you get the advantage, it's going to be very hard. And like I said, with white, he was just trying here and there. In the Petrov, he was not so successful. But then again, this idea, of course, this Catalan type of setup with b3 and c4, this worked out perfectly. And it's just one of those things. It's in this match, I had the feeling that openings were very important to get the surprise and get an idea, and Magnus finally managed in that game and got the win going, even though, of course, there were many, many adventures in that game six.
Yeah. And for any World Chess Championship opening junkies, Sagar Shah of Chess Base India has now done interviews with Peter Hein Nielsen and Vladimir Potkin, the head trainers of both players.
This
and they go through every game. It's obviously on video as well. They're 90 minutes each, and definitely recommend listeners check them out. And Peter Hein Nielsen said the same thing as you were when regarding the marshal, just that basically elite players, they kind of knew that it wouldn't be a mainline marshal once they decided that Magnus would go down that route. Now, Erwin, you know, in our prior interview, we talked about your work with computers. You mentioned you basically have like a hardcore engine running all the time in your dwelling, as well as sometimes using cloud engines. But I'm curious, a match like this, what's your approach to watching it? Do you have an engine running? Do you tend to watch broadcasts, or do you just like to feel it on your own?
Yeah, like I said, I'm a fan like anyone else. So first of all, I had all the broadcasts open, and in some I muted the sound.
Ah.
So there was one was really open, and then I would switch around between.
That's a grandmaster move there, yeah.
Yeah. So I had like four or five broadcasts that I could choose from. I really liked Fabiano's insights.
Yeah, he was great.
I really enjoyed those. I mean, there's someone who has experienced it all, of course, and I think you could really notice that in his comments, and Anish and Polgar, I watched a lot, obviously. Also great. I like they had some clashes here and there. It was nice to follow. Yeah, and then I have like you said, I have my engines running. I'm just curious of what's happening. Some opening surprise. I want to know what they're up to. Of course, it's very hard to reach that same kind of depth that the teams have been working. So you never really get to reach the same level of depth very quickly. But these days, with a good engine, you can really very quickly go through critical lines. So I just try to catch up as much as I can on what they were working on, and in that way, try to also guess what the next opening would be. It's just like any other fan. Actually, I think many fans followed it in that way. I guess.
Yeah, I certainly did. I mean, I would have SES open, the sort of Norwegian engine, the Super Stockfish that you can view online. Now, were you running your own engine on top of that sort of thing? Or
definitely. Yeah, definitely. No, I was definitely moving the pieces around. You know, SES, of course, you just look at the output, and you cannot really move around. But I, of course, try to analyze a bit, try to see. In that way, you can go much deeper, of course. So, I definitely had a lot of fun doing it. I canceled all other things. I was just following the match religiously, and that's all I did. Yeah, like any other, enjoying match by match. It for me, it was just. We will get to it, but it was really disappointing how it ended. I was genuinely gutted a little bit by how that all. Because it was such a great start. Of course, people generally don't like draws, but I think. The first five games, most of them were very hard fought, and for me, very interesting opening discussions. That alone already makes it very interesting for me to see which directions the teams have chosen. It shows a lot about how they think about the opponent and about themselves, and all these kind of things. Very interesting to just follow it closely.
Yeah, and. You know, I want to talk about other things besides the match too, but I do want to follow up on two more things relating to your watching the specific games. Number one, with game two. Now, I'm a much weaker player than you, so that could have like colored my output. But I was, you know, being a air quote slave to the engine and watching Magnus be like -2 out of the opening after briefly having an advantage. What was your perspective at that time? Because, like, again, not being strong enough, obviously I see that Magnus can create some problems, but in hindsight, I feel like I was giving Black too much credit just based on the engine. What did you think was the most likely result on, like, say, move 20 of game two?
Yeah, you mean this moment where
Magnus Saxon exchange and
Nepo found knight c5, knight b3. I think knight c5 is what Carlsen mentioned. He had
yeah missed. He missed that yeah. Yeah,
it's very hard to say. Computers, of course, are ruthless. It's something I noted before that nowadays what happens on the board and what the engine is showing as the truth, it gets more and more apart. As engines get stronger, I mean, nowadays, I see a completely normal position. I look at the engine, it shows -5. I sometimes don't even know why.
Right.
You know? And in the old days, in such positions, engine would show like -1 or -2. And it would feel a bit better, you know, because nowadays, every move we make, a computer shouts blunder, you know, everybody thinks that's, but it's just because the engines, they become stronger and stronger and stronger. And yeah, what happens on the boards, like I said, it very often has very little to do with what is actually what the engine is saying, and I think this game is a good example because I mean you have this knight on d6, and it's just very hard to assess it properly as a human and to also know exactly what are you aiming for. I mean, I remember during that game one of the things that the engine was shouting all the time was that black should take on a4. With the b5 pawn,
yeah,
which basically essentially means that you're doubling both your a pawns and just leave every pawn. I mean, those kind of decisions are very hard to make for your woman, but of course, an engine calculates it, sees some concrete reason why it's good, and it says that black is winning there. I think that objectively in a human game, black was doing fine there, but was doing perhaps very well. But I never had the idea that it was. You know, already in the realm of clearly winning positions or something. I did think that later on there was some chance. But once again, I'm going a bit into details now, but black could have gone queen g7, attacking
the
e5 pawn.
Yeah.
I thought that was actually a pretty human thing to see. I mean, that you attack e5 and then break the position open with g6, g5. I thought that was actually a chance that was missed. And after that, actually, towards the end, I was even thinking that Magnus might be able to try it with that knight on d6 and already having a pawn for the exchange. And then, but okay, he allowed this exchange on d6 to happen, and then it all fizzled out. But that game is a perfect illustration of what differentiates engines from humans. I believe.
Yeah, definitely a lesson learned for me. And lastly, on the match, I just wanted to hear your sort of broad thoughts on game six, since obviously it kind of decided the match. And also, I mean, just so historical in so many ways.
Yeah, it's just vintage Carlsen, right? I mean, he's always ready to sit out this kind of game, to just grind and grind and grind. I mean, he was arguably lost in that game at some point as well.
Yeah,
but he deals with this kind of trends. Evaluations going up. He deals with them very well, and then he gets this kind of end game where he just excels. He's probably. I think it's safe to say he's the best end game player to have ever walked the planet.
Yeah,
and you see him slowly torturing his opponent. It was very impressive to see, and actually. Nepo did fine, yeah, for a long time. He defended quite well, made some minor mistakes, perhaps practically speaking, allowing Magnus to take on a3, for instance, was probably not very practical, made his task a lot harder. But even after that, objectively speaking, he was still well within the game, but Magnus just kept pressing and pressing, and yeah, okay, the whole... 8 hours, 136 move. What was it? I mean, it's really an epic game. It's fantastic. I followed all the way, obviously, and really impressive how he managed to pull that off. I can imagine it's clearly a breaking point, of course. Nevertheless, I was hoping that Nepo would have somehow sorted this kind of thing out before the match, because everybody was. Already saying before the match that this is something he has to work on, that if he loses one game, that he sometimes tends to, you know, it just tends to all go away from him. And I was really hoping that he would manage to deal with that so that we could see the match continue in the same way, because at that point in time, okay, he had lost one game, but it still looked very close, the match. It didn't seem to me that the match would already be decided at that point.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, if anything, going into game six, it seemed like Nepo had a couple clearer shots than Magnus. And yeah, definitely could have ended many different ways. But
yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, also if you speak opening wise, Magnus got this surprise in game two, 95, but it was actually Nepo who quickly took over. So he really showed a lot of he showed good play, confident play actually in the beginning. Yeah, of course, I cannot speak to how tense a world championship is. I mean, I've been part of a team, but I haven't played, obviously.
Right.
So it must be immense, the pressure. I've seen Topalov up close dealing with it very well, I should say. But everybody deals with that differently. And yeah, perhaps it just became too much. That's something I can easily imagine, but of course, not something I can relate to.
Yeah, likewise. So did Topalov in your interactions, did he have a conscious game plan for how to handle the pressure, or do you think he was just kind of wired that way?
Yeah, I think that's just how he's wired. Yeah, it's just some people are just wired. Yeah, it's not fair how some people some people deal with such things. Veselin was always ready to fight. Always. There was just I don't know if you recall that match with Anand at the games, etc. I mean, they were so hard fought. It's just he was ready to go till the end every single game, and that's also how he played his tournaments and everything. It was it was quite inspirational, I'd say, to be part of that, because it was really I think quite an example also for Magnus growing up. Let's say 2008, 2009. Topalov was still a number one player, the one everybody looked up to, let's say. And Magnus, I think, took a lot from that fighting spirit that Topalov also showed in those days.
Yeah, I mean, he took it from somewhere.
Yes.
He has it, for sure.
No, obviously, yeah, it's something that he has in him, obviously. But definitely, I think these two, Magnus and Veselin, they're very similar in the way they approach the games, always ready to fight till the end.
And what about your boss slash friend Anish Giri? I mean, obviously hasn't been in the world championship, but of course, no stranger to the candidates. If you may or may not be able to address this with full disclosure, but is he doing stuff to work on sort of the mental game and responding to setbacks and stuff like that?
Yeah, and I actually think he deals with them very well. I mean, I've rarely seen him after a loss that he's completely. He's very good at looking at the game objectively, drawing the conclusions from it, and moving on in a healthy way. That's just a huge quality that I think a top player must have in order to be successful. Otherwise, it's just not gonna. I mean, you're gonna have setbacks, plenty of them usually, and you just have to be ready for. I mean, I remember speaking to him after the candidates. I mean, you could think, of course, that for many people it would have been a heartbreaking experience. The way it ended there, him losing to Grishuk in the last round and also the round before. That was tough, of course, but he handled it very well. Immediately started talking about future plans and they wanted to get back already. Was inspired to work, etc. So yeah, like I said, everybody deals with these things differently. But it's important, I think, to if it's not possible for you to deal with them properly, that you have to work on that, because otherwise it's just not the way it now happened in the match. Yeah, it may sound very rough, but I think it just cannot happen that way. You have to deal with that before the match. It somehow, something had to be done on that front, I think. And it didn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, there was a dichotomy between Nepo, again, rightfully has been praised so much for his comportment during the press conferences. A lot of people pointed out that, you know, it's in the contract for him to do the press conferences, which of course is true. But the point is he could be there and he could still, you know, he could have been rude. He could have shut down, but I felt like he was very open and took responsibility. But what the dichotomy was between his sort of public comportment and what one might think was going on in his head based on how the play progressed in the match.
I thought that was very impressive. Yeah. Exactly what you just said. I mean, to blunder in the match and to having to sit in front of the journalist again, and this NRK guy asking him about his performance. You know, you just want to, just, I mean, big respect for the way he handled that. That was really, really, really impressive. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But I think it's different from, let's say, sitting behind the board and being ready to fight. It's slightly different, but definitely it deserves a lot of respect the way he handled those situations, because I also remember different press conferences. And I liked that I saw someone writing that back in the day, it would have been better not to ask those questions to someone like Coach Neuer.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Probably the journalist would not have survived.
Yeah. Don't ask Coach Neuer why a move was described as absurd.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we've got some other topics to get to, Erwin, but first we're going to take a break and hear from our sponsors. What is new from Chessable, you ask? Well, friend of the pod FM Camille Plichta just dropped Lifetime Repertoire's Accelerated Dragon. I know a lot of Accelerated Dragon enthusiasts have been waiting for that, and I've heard rave reviews. I am Christoph Zalecki, aka Chess Explained, has a Keep It Simple Black repertoire coming soon. And of course, whether it be an opening course, a tactics course, or an in-game course on Chessable, you can utilize their proprietary space repetition technology to make sure you learn the lessons that are being imparted. So be sure to go to chessable.com and have a look at what's new. Good news, listeners. According to aimchess.com, I'm now only behind on the clock 75% of the time in my blitz games. That's actually huge progress for me. I'm going to keep working to bring it up, and I recommend you use aimchess.com to address whatever weaknesses you may have in your game, whether it be playing with the white or black pieces, a particular opening, or a particular phase of the game. They give tailored lessons for whatever their algorithm detects, and of course, their algorithm scrapes the games from the major chess playing sites themselves in order to tell you what you need. If you decide to subscribe to aimchess.com after checking it out, be sure to use the promo code perpetual30. Details are in the show notes. Check out aimchess.com. So, Erwin, you've got Tata Steel coming up, and I've got a burning question for you that I've been meaning to ask many guests. You know, Tata Steel, one of the landmark classical chess tournaments on the calendar every year. And as I've mentioned before, I love the sort of the iconic background of the North Sea, and I've never been there. And I've often wondered, is that a poster or is that actually a window overlooking the sea? And those who have watched Tata Steel will know what I'm referring to.
No, that is actually a poster. Yeah, that is giant. How do you call that? It's just a giant poster that they. It's a sports hall where we play in, and before the tournament starts, they spend a few days preparing the entire venue. So they hang this poster along the all the walls. Actually, are covered with this typical Tata Steel tournament. Poster, is that the word?
I mean, there might be another word for it, but it gets across the idea. Yeah, that was my working assumption because the view is just too perfect, but I had to ask just to be sure. So you've got this tournament coming up in the Challengers section with Lucas Van Forest and some top young players, Taidan Van Nguyen, Rinat Jumabayev, who's extremely strong young player, Ganguly. So have you been finding time to prep and how are you feeling?
Yeah, since the match finished earlier than expected, yes. I'm now going to prepare for the event. Now, I was already thinking a bit about, because I haven't played in a long time, actually. So I've definitely given some good thought on this tournament. It's, by the way, but people know that I think it's by far my favorite. It's like a home event for me. I've been playing there since 2005. And it's every year it's fantastic to come there. The atmosphere, I mean, you've never been, but to me it's very rare that you see hundreds of people visiting the tournament hall. Obviously, this year with COVID, it's going to be a little bit more difficult probably. It's going to be a little bit smaller, and perhaps there will be no visitors this year, which would be a pity. I don't know that for a fact, by the way, but I'm assuming that something will change compared to the normal years. Last year was also different, of course, but nevertheless, I'm looking forward to it tremendously. And the Challengers group, it's traditionally a group where a lot of talents get the chance to, first of all, gain experience, but also get the chance, of course, to qualify to the Masters group. I mean, Magnus Carlsen played in the Challengers. Then it was called the B group, but he started, of course, famously in the C group, B group, A group, etc. And many other players who are now playing in the A group, they started in the earlier group. So I've played many strong grandmasters over the years there, which are now playing in the A group. It's going to be fantastic. I cannot wait, actually.
Yeah, and the aforementioned Anish Giri, of course, will be in the Masters section along with Carlsen, Caruana, Mamajarov, Rapport, Duda, Karjakin, Vidit, Dubov, Asapenko, Shanklin, Jordan Van Forest, Grandelius, and Pragananda. So just an amazing lineup, and anyone who's been following the chess gossip might be looking forward to a Dubov against Karjakin match in particular.
Yeah, that's also a topic. Should we discuss that one, or do we leave that for others?
Yeah, it's up to you. I guess while you decide if you want to say anything, I'll just quickly explain for anyone who didn't catch it. Basically, it's been recently, they did a Chess24 released an awesome video describing who was on Magnus's team, sort of doing a big reveal. And it wasn't like super surprising. Friend of the pod, Jan Gustafsson, was there again, as well as Laurent Frissonnet. Of course, Peter Hein Nielsen heads the team. And then the two new additions, although they'd been, Dubov in particular had been speculated about, were Daniil Dubov and your Dutch compatriot, young superstar Jordan Van Forest. And Karjakin and a couple other Russian players basically sort of suggested it was unpatriotic for him to be working on the team of this Norwegian player when a Russian was in the championship. I personally won't editorialize about it. You're welcome to address it or not, Erwin.
Yeah, it's a dangerous topic. I would say that I think this kind of things, they differ from country to country. I think in some countries, these things are taken much more harshly than in others. And I think particularly in Russia, they feel very strongly about bringing the crown, the title back home, and this kind of thing. So for them, it's probably hard to see fellow Russian working for Magnus. On the other hand, as far as I understood, they've been working for, well, I know that they've been working for a long time already. They started working again already before the candidates, if I read the article correctly. So I don't think anything really bad happened here. But yeah, as I said, it's per country. I mean, everybody looks at these things differently. So I'm not really sure how to view it. Me personally, I don't really see the very big deal. But that could be just, from my Dutch perspective, I don't know.
Yeah, I'll admit it. I don't see it as a big deal either.
Okay. Okay.
But hopefully, hopefully that story kind of blows over and doesn't like escalate. That I wouldn't.
Yeah,
that
would be a pity. Obviously, I mean that's completely unnecessary. And I of course there are some emotions now. The match just finished. I'm just hoping that in some time, these things will boil down.
Yeah, and Erwin, I do have to ask you one other hard-hitting question. Another Dutch compatriot, legendary GM Jan Timman, when I interviewed him on the show, mentioned that the reason Ferrugia isn't in the tournament is because he's been told that they couldn't come to terms. So again, I don't know if you can address this, but have you heard anything about this? Like they couldn't come to financial terms, to be clear.
Okay, honestly, no idea. Honestly, no. I'm playing there more or less every year, but I'm not part of negotiations with.
Okay.
But obviously, it would have been great to have. I mean, I'm hoping he'll be back in the future. I mean, they had this unfortunate thing last year, but I don't think that should. I hope at least it doesn't play any role. For I mean, I'm sure that everybody would like to see him in Wijkenzee, and I'm sure he would also like to win Wijkenzee. Just hope but I don't know how those negotiations happened.
Yeah, and it's still an amazing lineup. I mean, they always do a good job of you have your old stalwarts, but also there's always some newer players. I'm excited to see, especially
the mix is great. Normally, let's say Norway Chess is a fantastic event, but you have the top players there usually, and a Norwegian player. I don't mean Magnussen. Right. While in Vikings A, it's of course much more mixed, and I kind of like that. It's a tournament where up and coming 2,700 players can really find their breakthrough. They get to play Magnussen, get to play top players, and if they do well, they can really establish themselves. So in that sense, I think it's a great event for. Yeah, and anyone basically, top event players and guys who are just beneath that and aspiring to come up.
Yeah, and of course, Van Forest managed to win it last year, kind of being in that situation.
It was amazing. That was absolutely. I mean, since 85, we had been waiting for a Dutch winner. Timan won it in 1985, last time. Anish, of course, was close many times, including actually last year.
Yeah,
close. I was there with Anish, so I couldn't actually be that happy initially. But of course, as time goes, I mean, I can still be very happy for Jordan. Obviously, that he won there. I mean, that was a fantastic thing for Dutch chess. I mean, the media was all over this tournament in the Netherlands. So that in that sense, it really brought brought the tournament in the limelight in a very positive way. And for Jordan, it's great that he made his breakthrough now. So because we had, of course, Anish in the Netherlands. But after Anish, it was a very big gap towards the rest of the Dutch players. So now we have a clear, we have a new guy over 2,700, or at least he's established himself now around 2,700. I think he's just over now again.
Yeah, he is.
Just over, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's very nice. He gets to play Vikings A now again. So he worked with Magnus.
Yeah.
So I think that should all be very should inspire him to perhaps make some more stuff. I mean, if you manage to win Vikings A, then definitely you can aspire to go even higher than 2,700, I think.
For sure. And for you, Erwin, you said you haven't been as active. So as you ramp up, I'm sure you've got to brush up on your openings. Do you do any other sort of training in a moment like this?
Yeah, well, I'm trying now to play some blitz and stuff like that because, I'll have to play soon. Yeah. So I have to get back in shape a little bit. So I'm doing that a lot. Of course, I'm in touch still with Anish all the time. So that also continues. I'm going to do two courses actually for Chessable. I have in the making, one with Christoph Selecki. That's going to be on the triangle Slav and one on the Slav itself. It should come out somewhere in the next year. So that's very exciting. And I'm sort of constantly working on that as well in between the other things. So that's just like a nice project also to constantly work on. So I keep busy in that way.
Excellent. And do you do like tactical training at this stage of your career?
Absolutely. No, I think that's something that everybody keeps doing all the time. I don't think that ever stops. And especially now when I haven't been that active, I feel like it's something I definitely have to do, and I'm doing it as well. And initially I was so slow and bad, missing things. But then in time, you see that you get a little bit sharper, you start to see things, and that's a good feeling. So I'm hoping that, I'm back in time for what I can say.
Yeah, and I know that you're an avid bibliophile and chess bibliophile. For when you're working on your tactics, what do you tend to use, Erwin?
Actually, for this nowadays, I switch to the digital world.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry
for
all. It's awful. But I have recently purchased the book of Frank Erwig. Do you know Frank Erwig?
I don't think so.
He's a Dutch Fidem Master friend of mine. He's my my agent. He published a book. Full with combinations based on theme, and it's very nice. It's for the stronger club players, so that means it's kind of perfect for me as well to just leave through and just try to quickly solve. And very often I'm still going wrong. So he made a very nice selection. He's a trainer as well, so he really selected those things over years, and quite like that that one. On the topic of books, Sattler's last book is great as well. It's a complete little bit off topic, but. I really enjoy, everything he writes I enjoy generally, but recently he's been, of course, ever since Game Changer, I think he's made a jump into the engine world, and he really makes that world look very, he has a very engaging way of writing, and he, it's a fantastic book, very interesting, and it shows something that I also feel personally very strongly about that in the past, people used to say that, well, don't use a computer when you try to get better at chess, don't use an engine, don't look at the engine. But he actually tries to show the reader how you can improve from working with an engine. Because nowadays, in the old days, engines were good at pointing out tactics, but they would not really be good at just, you know, making good moves. But these days, of course, engines can do anything. So it's very much worth working with engines to improve your game. And he had many interesting ideas and suggestions for people to improve their game in that way. And I thought it was a very interesting read.
Yeah, Erwin, of course, is referring to Matthew Sadler's The Silicon Road to Chess Improvement. I've been reading that as well. I'm hoping to interview him soon. And yeah, it's striking. He just exudes joy for like a lot of people. A lot of people, when once engines get involved, I think especially at the club level, like you can use them to check the best move, but they don't tend to like enliven your interest in chess. But for him, it's the total opposite. He doesn't mind just getting crushed by the engine like 30 games in a row.
What I really enjoyed also, I'm not sure if it was him or if it was someone else, but I saw him online tweeting about this. He various game positions from the match to come back to the match also, he actually fed them to his engines and let them play these positions out. So like bishop takes b4, for example, this famous moment where Nepo missed a chance.
Yeah, in game six,
He gave this position to the engines, let them play it out. And it was very interesting to see his conclusions. And it's really, it's an account also on Twitter to follow because he posts new engine stuff every single day. Beautiful games, fragments, analysis. It's very, very interesting to read and to follow.
Yeah, and he's got an underfollowed YouTube channel related to the book as well. And of course, his recaps with Kasparov were awesome. So
No, it's all stuff. Everything Kasparov. Everything with Kasparov is great, of course. When it comes to chess, I'm just it's fantastic. I mean, as a child, coming back to Vikings A again, I was present in this game between Kasparov and Topalov.
Yeah.
From a childhood, and okay, I guess for most people, in fact, but from childhood, I've always, he's this larger than life person. So every time he speaks about chess, I'm just completely, I'm just listening, just whatever it is. It's I'm loving it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the combination with Sutton is great because he also really knows how to get the best out of Gary.
I agree. You've told the story of the epic Kasparov-Topalov game in Vikings A, but I don't believe we discussed. Have you met Kasparov in person, Erwin?
But not like, I mean, we don't really know each other. No, I mean, okay. I've seen him, for example, in the St. Louis in the St. Louis events where he played, and Anish was also there. But we no, I don't really know him in that sense. No.
Me either.
Yeah, unfortunate. Yeah, and he of course retired in 2000. I mean, I've played against Carlsen, against Arnand, against Kramnik. In Vikings A, I had most of those opportunities were in Vikings A. But yeah, Kramnik, of course, Kasparov, I should say, retired of course earlier, so I never got the chance to play him. That would have been of course epic.
Yeah, for sure. All right, well, Erwin, we got to take one more break, and then we've got some great Patreon mailbag opening related questions for you. So I think you can handle them. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by ChessMood.com. ChessMood was founded in 2018 by Grandmaster Avtek Grigorian. It's a chess education platform that gives you a structured path to work to improve your chess. For $29 a month, you get instant access to over 200 hours of Grandmaster prepared video content and includes openings, middle games, and end games. They also have an active online community where you can find training partners and fellow chess enthusiasts. Don't forget to check out their free content. They have a great blog where their grandmasters share their own thoughts on chess improvement. I get it delivered to my inbox. So to learn more about Chess Mood and what they offer, be sure to check out their website, chessmood.com. And we are back, Erwin. And number one is the hard-hitting question from frequent question submitter who's been sending in some great ones, Alex Friedman, which is E4 still best by test?
Wow, Bobby Fischer fan.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's hard to say. Is it still best by test? I think nowadays, at the top level, we speak about top level, I assume. I think that nowadays, a player just looks at the other at the opponent that he's playing on the next day, and just decides which course to take, where he has an idea, he or she has an idea, an opening idea. And to say that e4 is better than d4 at this point, it's, I mean, after e4 right now, objectively speaking, Marshall, Berlin, Petrov, it's all completely fine for black. But against d4, of course, there are similar issues.
Which openings against d4 do the engines like the best?
Nowadays, there is this endgame, let me just say the moves, because I seem to have forgotten the name, d4, knight f6. C4, E6, knight F3, D5, knight C3, C5.
Okay.
And now C takes D5, C takes D5. This endgame has been played now, many times on top level. For instance, Arjan Tari drew against Carlsen last year in Wijk aan Zee with black, actually, just like that. That's one issue. Of course, also very solid. The way, for instance, Nippon now played the Catalan. From a white perspective, that is actually one of the few areas where you can still try to probe, because after knight c3 we get into that endgame instead of g3, if you understand what I mean. So while in e4 generally is of a more forcing nature, so there, I mean, for example, the Petrov is just one big forcing variation, basically, in whichever direction you take, because in the Petrov, because of the symmetry, if you don't immediately strike, there's just nothing much is going to happen. Black will just develop, and it will just be rather dry. The structure is such that nothing, you cannot expect much. So you have to play in a very forceful manner. That's the only way to battle the Petrov. With Marshall, with Berlin, it's hard to say. I would say that by now, no first move is really doing it.
Yeah, black's doing well.
Black is doing fine, yeah. Actually, much better than, for instance, in the 90s, for example. If you speak about, like, say, if you go 30 years back in time, Berlin didn't exist yet in the 90s. Petrov was under pressure in those days. And black, back in those days, e4 was a really, people were struggling to equalize. And now it's more a matter of choice. Like, do I equalize with the Berlin or with the Marshall? And then, of course, it becomes a matter of finding the right try for the player playing with the white pieces. So if you have some idea and you can surprise your opponent, it's all about surprise. If you can surprise your opponent, then you can have some success. But objectively speaking, it's all completely fine for black. In any opening, any half-serious opening, black is more or less fine.
Yeah, surprise definitely seemed to be the angle that Team Magnus settled on.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, Nepo, he just took the stand of, I'm just playing correctly, and I'm just gonna, I just trust this opening, and I'm gonna be fine. And if I get surprised, I trust that the position is solid enough that I can just find my way.
Yeah. And it kind of played out the way, hearing you talk about it, it played out the way one might expect, and that, like, you know, just speaking from what the engine would say, often Nepo would have this like 0.2 type advantage, but Magnus knew the structure and knew how to neutralize it. So yeah, you can see why Magnus might go for worse moves that have an elevated chance of catching their opponent off guard, even if it didn't work.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I think Magnus, he knew exactly what he was doing in those marshals. He was taking these slightly worse positions, but he knew how to handle them, and most of the time he would neutralize them quite smoothly.
Yeah.
It's so hard to beat him there.
Yeah, and we have a related question from a friend and supporter of the pod, Evan Rosenberg. He actually has two questions, but I'm going to start with this one, which is one of them we just answered, but are you aware of any popular opening line that has actually been refuted by Leela or Stockfish? In other words, how soon can we expect an answer on whether or not the London system is any good?
I think it's by now very safe to say that the game of chess is drawn objectively.
Yeah.
And I think that's a certainty, given that the drawing margin is quite big. you cannot mate with bishop and king versus king, for example. I mean, piece up, but you cannot give mate. And we also see that certain openings are just very correct, rather equalish. So we cannot expect that much. And now I forgot the question, which was...
Yeah, any openings that were refuted by...
I actually think the opposite. I think that anything is possible as long as you analyze it deep enough. And that's that element of surprise. For instance, in that A4 anti-marshal that they played three times, the main move historically is B4 there. B4 or Bishop B7, but B4 is, let's say, the main move. But it's clear that Magnus just decided to go for Rook B8. He analyzed that very deeply, and the engine shows it's also playable. And he was deep enough, and he just played it. So I think that even as long as it's, of course, within boundaries, I think even much more is possible than before. I saw one match in the TCEC or the TSEC. I never know how to pronounce these engine matches. Two games in the King's Gambit, which were both drawn, I think. So I mean, everything is possible again, as long as it's well prepared, you know, deeply analyzed, which both teams in the World Championship, of course, did.
Okay, so King's Gambit fans can take heart that it might not be losing. White can maybe hold.
Yeah, at the same time, I don't think it's... Caruana said it very correctly. I think he said at some point during the commentary, they were discussing the possibility of Napo playing F4 on the second move. And then Caruana said something like, well, it's just an extremely bad opening. So it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
It's rough, but I'm afraid it's true. I think we all have a soft spot for this... opening, but I don't think we're gonna see much of it on the top level soon.
Yeah, it was funny to me that people would even suggest Nepo would play it in the World Championship. And Evan Rosenberg's other question was, he says, is there any utility to the role of a second for non-grandmasters? I'm a lowly NM getting ready to compete in my first round robin IM Norm Invitational. Would having a second be of any greater benefit than simply working with a coach, or is that excessive?
I would just very important. I think the strength of the player. I didn't hear in the question.
He's about 2,200 feet. Evan is
right, and he's going to play an IM event. Yeah, it's very hard. I mean, the role of a second and a coach, it is a bit of a gray area between the two. I mean, during for example, my work with Topalov during the match, I was a second. I mean, I was working on openings. 24 hours a day, but the engines were running 24 hours a day.
Right.
While as a coach, you also meet in between events. You try to improve someone's play. You work on areas that the player is not so good at. And I think up to a reasonably high level, that is still probably worth more than somebody just feeding you opening lines. And I think... at 2,200, that I think having a good coach is still more beneficial than having like a true second who just, you know, throws opening lines at you. But of course, ideally, you find yourself a coach that can guide you a little bit through the openings, and it can also tell you a little bit more about the game. So that's the perfect combination of things. So if he can find that person, I think he'll be set for his IM event.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Good advice there. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, Evan's a little stronger than me. We've actually played a couple training games. But for me, yeah, the mistakes are coming, you know, second or no second, one of us is going to screw up. So
no, I think let's say a beginner obviously benefits much more from somebody who gives him pointers like what should you be looking for in the game and what is the game of chess actually about, and then you get a bit more serious and then you get annoyed because this guy on the club, he plays his same opening line all the time and he all the time succeeds, and then right. You want to learn a little bit about that. But I think it should all be balanced I think most people find their own healthy balance in this, and well, maybe your friend likes to you know, go all out on openings, and if that makes him happy, and why not? So many people have improved that way. I remember Thibaut Caroli, I think, which is one of Lego's first trainers, he said that they just mostly worked on openings from an early age. And Lego did pretty well.
Yeah.
So I don't think there's one set way of improving in our game. It's just that for me personally, I think that, let's say, up to close to IM level, it can still make a lot more sense to just have a coach there that can guide you through the, you know, games, that can work on your improving your overall game. And the deep opening prep, I think that plays a bigger role later on.
Yeah, makes sense. All right, Erwin, and we have one more listener question for you. This one is from Igor Feinstein. And Igor asks, he says, considering that you're an opening expert, what is your recommendation for how category level players should approach studying openings? Do you have any specific books or resources? And then he also asks, do you recommend developing a narrow opening repertoire and study it deeply, or learning a wide range of openings and understand the concepts and instructions and structures inherent in them? Although I feel like if you're going to learn a wide one, it's going to be hard to understand all the structures. But anyway, I would almost repeat what I said before,
that I think there's not one set approach for this. And some people take great even pride in their opening work. They work on, they have an opening that they love, and they play it all the time, and they keep improving on it, and that's the way they improve, and I think that's fine. And other people, they despise opening work, and they would much rather prefer to have some kind of narrow repertoire. The London system you mentioned before, perfect opening to just, you know, play. You put the bishop on f4, you put a pawn on e3, get the bishop, the f1 bishop into the game, and you just start playing. And for many people, that works perfectly. And others would find that horrible. So I think it's very hard to say what kind of repertoire somebody should be choosing or playing when you are starting out. One of my first trainers, Cor van Weijeren, always said that the open games fits a beginner better, because there tends to be more of a clash early on, and then more tactics and more it fits better in the way you're learning the game. He certainly knows more about the topic than me, so I think that's an advice that is perhaps a good one to follow. And how to learn well, Chessable of course is an option, the move trainer. Other people might prefer to set up the pieces on their own. So also there, it's a bit boring. Maybe you prefer some rough statements of mine. But even here, I think that there are various ways to go about. I like the move trainer, and I think Chessable is doing a good job at showing the material that opening material. I use it myself, although not for openings, but for endgame trainings. Yeah. I worked a lot with the Vreski's Endgame Manual and this 100 Endgames You Must Know, which I think are two great courses on Chessable. And I often, you know, just when I'm in a train or wherever, I just take my phone and I browse a bit and I try to solve some endgame positions. But like I said, other people don't like to see it on the screen. They prefer to feel the pieces, you know, set up the board. And it's also fine. Invite a friend over and play through some opening lines yourself. There are so many ways to enjoy that work. I would feel bad to... Well, actually, myself, I study it even in various ways. I work with the computer, but then sometimes I set it up on the board and I look a bit at it and try to move the pieces a bit. And I see that I again get some new ideas and new questions pop up. So there's no set way, I think, of doing things. And I think everybody should just find the way which works for them. I know from Anish that he rarely, I think, sets up the board for these kind of things. He just he's so used to just the screen and chess base. And that's, of course, normal because we all use engines constantly. But I noticed in myself that I still like sometimes to just, you know, sit behind the board and just see a little bit what's happening. And so each his own there, each his own.
Okay, yeah. And you gave some excellent advice in our first interview too, along the same lines of pursuing what you enjoy when you're a chess hobbyist. I think it's evergreen advice. I think it's important not to lose sight of that. And just a couple more follow-ups, or when the hearing you talk chess, which I always enjoy, makes me jogs my memory about things to ask you about. So number one, of course, you mentioned working with a legendary co-creator of the Step series, Cor van Weygarten. I apologize, Cor, if I mispronounced your last name. And, you know, I've been working through, I've taught that series in the past and just been working through it on my own. And I'm really struck by the creativity of all the puzzles in them and the depth. So I'm curious, from having worked with him as a child, did you notice any secret sauce? How was he able to just come up with all these original positions? And again, Rob Brunia, I'm sure, like co-create, I should say.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, he's just, it's very simple. I think he's just a very hard worker. And from his early training years, he just collects. I mean, he has this giant database with an enormous amount of positions that he just collected over the years, day in, day out. And I'm sure that he still has thousands of positions waiting to be included in future books. It was always very impressive. Yeah, he had an enormous amount of training material. It's famous that people like Luc van Wely, Erik van der Doel, Dutch grandmasters. They would play a tournament back in the day, and they would phone up Cor, and they would ask, like, "Well, do you have some positions for me? Because I need to, you know, I need to get in shape a little bit." And then he would send over some pages with exercises, and that's how they would, they would sharpen their tactics before. So yeah, he is like the Dutch coach. Famous step methods, obviously. Yeah.
Yeah, and for any listeners, longtime listeners will have heard me discuss the steps method many times. But for others, you can listen to my interview with Hans Schut and Jaap Delamar, among others, to hear us discuss it. And the last question, Erwin, was about, with computers, I've been hearing more and more about sort of the move to the cloud. And of course, there was the question at the press conference about apparently one of the marshal, I think it was the first time that Magnus played Rook B8. Someone asked him, they said that someone had been looking at it on the engine, on Chessbase, on the online engine 2 days before, and like had forgot. There's an option to not leave tracks, and someone had forgotten to select that option.
Yeah, it's the first thing I do usually when I get a new new computer. I install Chessbase, and then I deactivate the option of restoring everything. Yeah,
that's a pro move there. But I was curious to what extent these top teams and your such as yourself and Anish, to what extent is your work now done on cloud based engines as compared to, like, you know, running massive machines in your houses?
I think the days where you have these massive machines at home, that's sort of finished. I think Anish is very open also about it. He is ambassador of Chessify.
For Chessify, yeah.
And they provide him with enormously strong hardware. And I myself also use Chessify. It's of course costly, but for professionals, or for very ambitious amateur players, it's absolutely fantastic, because it's not something I've seen before in the chess world to that extent. It's really, for me, there could be something out there that I'm not aware of, but from what is publicly available, let's say, to rent, I think Chessify is the strongest out there. And like I said, you pay, of course, it's a serious investment, but then you have the best hardware out there. And Anish is using that. I think Aronian also is one of the embedded, is also been using that a lot. And basically the point is, I think that everybody's looking for these cloud solutions now. Chessify is one of the front runners right now. But okay, I'm sure that, there were already rumors of supercomputers in Team Napo. I should say that in 2010, there was also such a rumor.
Oh, yeah.
It was not a rumor. We could make use of this famous supercomputer, but it just that they didn't manage to make it work. Some scaling issues basically the engines at that time, I think it was Ripka 4 that we had, they were not able to run those engines on these super computers. So basically, we had access to a giant computer, but we couldn't do anything with it. That was the painful part. But of course, nowadays, it's probably different. I guess that it's very likely that Nepo's team had access to something great and that they could run engines there properly. It's just that nowadays, at some point, I think it's hard to really make a difference still. I've seen this now with Chessify, their strongest engine that runs on 1 billion nodes a second. And yeah, once you have that, I mean, yeah, you can have 2 billion, 3 billion, but I don't know what a difference it still makes. It's all so incredibly fast. And if someone like that's also important. Magnus playing the Marshall, which is such a correct opening. Yeah, what difference can you really make with the hardware that you have? And that's, I think, one of the points even also behind Magnus's choice, that it's just very much engine-proof what he was doing. What he said is basically, I can get out of the opening with a slightly worse position, but I'll be sort of fine. I'll just handle it. Like I said, 0-20. Yeah, what's 0-20? If he makes one, two good moves, it might just already peter out to a draw. So this is, I think, one of the things that that they also chose for as a team.
Yeah, Peter Hein-Nielsen, even before the match, in an interview, someone asked him about Nepo's alleged supercomputer from a Russian university, and he said, they may have the strongest computer, but we have the strongest human.
It's shots fired, yeah? Before the match.
Exactly. Yeah, they fired a few shots, and they managed to back it up.
But the painful thing is, of course, when such a thing is said, it's actually true. Yeah? That's,
right.
Yeah, that makes it, I mean, you can say it's cocky or whatever, but it's true. That makes it,
Yeah, Magnus has been a little vocal on Twitter. I mean, I of course always would love to interview him, but now in particular, because it really seems like, I mean, he had said some very, very sort of optimistically tinged things prior to the match, but it seems like he was unusually confident before this match.
I saw some tweets. No, it makes. I mean, he was a big favorite. But he really was. Yeah, but like I said, I think given the first six games, as we conclude a bit the match talk. I mean, after these first six games, it's a pity how it all unfolded.
Yeah.
It would have really been a great match. And now, I don't think in 10 years' time we'll be talking much about it still. It's a bit of a... if I compare it with the Karjakin match or the Caruana match, not the same.
Yeah, and with time, it might be easy to forget just how tense the first six games were.
Yeah, exactly. I think people already forgot. I mean, people look at it like Magnus crushed Nepo, but if you would just show someone the first six games, you would just say that, oh, this is anybody could win this match.
Yeah. All right, well, Erwin, this has been amazing, as expected. Do you have anything you'd like to address before we wrap this up?
Well, I'm just looking forward to the next match.
Yeah.
Is it next year already, or are they going to try to get the restore the 1 year they lost, or is it in 2 years? I don't even know, to be honest.
I have heard that they're moving. They're just going to move to an odd year cycle, so okay, 2023. Okay. But
that makes sense because of I think the Grand Prix finishes in April. The Grand Prix series.
I think later maybe, but yeah,
April, May, something like that. Yeah. Yeah. So that makes sense. Yeah. That makes sense.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's a long way to go still.
Yeah.
But we're looking forward, I think.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of interesting potential.
Of course,
matchups.
I'm hoping that next time I will be observing it from a little bit closer with Anish.
That
would, of course, be fantastic to experience that.
Yeah. So he's got to get in through the Grand Prix with such a gauntlet, 24 players for two spots.
It's going to be tough. I do like the new setup of the event. So with the round robins first and then the final round robin. I think that's a nice new way of making it also a little bit more exciting, because those events, they were usually, there were a lot of draws. They were not very popular. the Grand Prix. It was this Grand Prix series that was always a little bit of the black sheep of the whole cycle, I think. And now I think it could get interesting. So I'm curious about this. And okay, Anish, he did, of course, well in the last cycle. He was close. So yeah, I'm curious if he can, if he can do it again. Maybe a little bit better even this time.
Yeah, and I don't know if you can speak for him in this case, but I was, given what we're saying about how hard it is to qualify, I personally was quite surprised he didn't play in the FIDE Grand Swiss. I don't know if there's anything you could say about that decision of Anish's.
Yeah, I'm not even 100% sure what it was. I think, no, you caught me a little bit off guard there.
Yeah, I mean, I know, like...
That was not a decision that we discussed together. I think it was something related with other commitments. But yeah, no, sorry, no. I would you would have to ask him. I'm not 100% sure on what the reasoning was exactly. No, but of course, that was also a chance to qualify. So in general, he would, of course, try to be there, I think. On the other hand, now it's clear that it has to happen via the Grand Prix. So it's, yeah. It's clear. We have a clear target now.
Excellent. All right. And good luck to Anish as well as, should be fun. I would love to see him in the candidates.
Yes, no, that would be great. Of course. That would be just, that's something that we, of course, will be striving for now. That's the main goal right now.
Yeah. Makes sense. Okay. Well, Erwin, thanks so much. So with Chasuble, you've got your two courses with IM Christoph Zalecki. Is that what's next in the pipeline?
Yes, those two courses. So one on the Slav that I will do by myself, one on the Triangle Slav. So that's with starting with the moves D5, E6, and C6.
Okay.
So we'll discuss the Notenboom variation, very sharp, Marshall Gambit. So it's very, very interesting a course that will be. And then on the Slav, yeah, I'm planning to do something new also, a little bit on the topic of what we spoke about earlier, that how to study openings. In the Slav, for instance, I'm recommending one variation. I'm not going to details where Black sacrifices a piece on E4 and gets three pawns for the piece. And there are many typical endgames there. And I'm going to be trying not to just give the moves, but also to show how to play typical endgames in this variation. I'm trying to push it a little bit to a broader broader course so that people understand also more about the line, apart from just the moves, let's say. So I'm hoping that will work out. It's something I haven't done before to this extent. So it's going to be a bit bigger, this course, than normal, and it's going to feature more purely chess-related stuff next to the pure moves. We discuss typical positions that come out of the opening and how to deal with them. And as such, I'm trying to give more understanding to the student on how to play the opening. So that's the idea.
Sounds good to me. Yeah. We need all the understanding we can get.
And I guess in 2 years we'll be back to discuss the match that has happened then.
Sounds good to me, Erwin. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
It was great to be back here.
Perpetual Chess is proud to be a member of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Be sure to check out their sports and pop culture related podcasts as well. I also, as always, would like to thank Matthew Passy for producing the show. Without Matthew, Perpetual Chess would not exist. And I want to thank everyone who listens to the show, whether it be on your own without telling anyone about it, keeping it secret, or if you're helping to spread the word, all the better, whether it be telling a friend about a particularly impactful interview or whether it be writing a positive review online, all of that stuff helps get the word out and helps Perpetual Chess continue to grow. But most of all, of course, I want to thank those that provide financial support to Perpetual Chess. Without you all, Perpetual Chess would not be possible in its current form. And I would like to give special thanks to the following people and entities. Here comes the list. Chessable.com, David Lazarus of Lasman Chess, coach of Dave's Young Tigers on Lee Chess, Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, the Abysmal Depths of Chess blog, Adaptive Interactive Web Designs and Services, The Apprentice Twitch Channel, Anidi Deer, Austin Clough, Benjamin Porto, Bill Sigler, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, The Charlotte Chess Center, The Chess Central's Chess Blog, ChessMood.com, Chris Flanagan, Chris Lott, Dan O'Hanlon, Daniel He, Danny Davidson, David Mitchell, I am Dimitri Schneider, Douglas Wilson, I am Eric Rosen, Farhan Tharwar, Faraz Sawaf, Gary Foreman, Glenn Downing, Greg Harfst, Greg Shahadi, Gregory Gulick, Hampus Axelson, James Kennedy, Jay Garrison, Jeff Martinson, Jeff Schaefer, Jeremy Nielsen, John Jernigan, John MacArthur, Kevin Forsyth, Kevin Gilmore, Kevin O'Callaghan, Kevin Pryor, King Cell, the King's Crusher YouTube channel, the Law Offices of Stuart Katz, Matthew Feeney, Michael Kahn, FM Michael Oplin, Mr. Mike Shahadi, Michael Sullivan, the famous Mr. Dodgy, the Nerdnase Twitch channel, Perry McManus, GM Peter Prohaska, Peter Sodi, Philip Flummins, the Playmore Chess Academy of the Hamden Chess Club, Ray Lillywhite, Reuven Fisher, Rick Rivas, Robert Hansen, Ross Crossland, the Seattle Chess Club, Shane Unger, Stefan Kelty, Stephen Martinez, Sven Gierson, Thomas Tachenko, Todd Bryant of StrongChess.com, Todd Kennedy, The Vintage Patsers, which is a Chess.com improver group, Wayne Beam, and I also would like to thank the following, hashtag ChessPunks, who are the adult improvers on Chess Twitter, Ace Vallega, Adam Fowler, Adam Johansson, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Al Hastings, Alan and Maggie Sue, Alex Pejas, Alexander Markovitz, Antonio Cancino, Antonio Leonfort, FM Andre Tarakov, Dr. Andrew Perry, Angus McLeod, Barry Hessian, Bill Gruber, Bill Juniper, Bill Moran, Bill Trammell, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brandon Halseed, Brian Chase, Brian Mullis, Bruce Scott, Bruno Johnson, Brian Tillis of Palm Beach Chess, Cameron Davis, Ken Kabadayi, Chad Hilton, Chad Likens, of Rose City Chess in Portland, the Chess Dojo, Chess for Charity Jacksonville, Chess Patser Spain, Dr. Charles Snodgrass, Chris Kiefer, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Shabri, Christopher Wood, I am Christoph Zalecki, aka Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Costa Carras, Courtney Fry, Craig Mallon, Daniel Ginsburg, Daniel Naylor, Dave Best, Dave Saylor, David Blaskacek, David Brown, David Gores, David Hamblin, David Cramley, David Peterson, Dennis Parrish, FM Donnie Ariel, Dwayne Edmonds, Ed Daly, Ed Mead, Edwin Rodriguez, Eric Baldwin, Ethan Smith, Evan Rosenberg, Ewan Richardson, Ian Mason, Felipe Mayo Perea, Fox Valley Chess Club, Francis Letard Lavoie, Frank Tortoris, MD, Frank Zananis, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Gautam Narula, Gene Stewart, George Foote, George Harris, Giovanni Russo, Gregory Higgins, Han Shu, Harish Srinivasan, Howard Vihan, Jacob Kovach, Jason Apollo, Jason Murray, Jacques Parry, James Aspinwall, James Benastia, James Muir, Jason Woolham, Jay Tuttle, Jaydeep Chakrabarty, Jeff Anderson, Jeff Davis, Jeffrey Martello, Yep Hoyland, Jerry Wells, Jesse DeCumos, Jesse McNulty, Jim Jones, Jim Ratliff, Jim Sadler, Joe DeSano, Joe Valdez, Joel Thomas Ramos, John McAdams, John Tully, Juan Almaguer, Dr. John Fallon, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman, John Jeffrey, John McMurtry, Jonathan Bannister, Jonathan Slater, John Quist, John Tully, Jose Rodriguez, Justin Gardner, Justin Goodfellow, Jen Shahadi, Joel Rocky, John Thompson, Grandmaster Josh Friedel, I am Kari Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Kyle McAvoy, Larry Cook, Larry Reifert, Lars Wiesen, Macaulay Peterson, Maria Emilianova, a.k.a. PhotoChess, Mark Chaves, Mark Fitzpatrick, Mark Miller, Mark Wilkins, Marco Butolovich, Martin Knudsen, Martin Krug, Matt Ferrari, Matthew Coughlin, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, Matthias Plock, Mechanics Institute Chess Club of San Francisco, Michael Allard, Michael Hudson, Mike Clem, Mitchell Fabian, Nate Goble, Nate Solon, Neil Bruce, Nigma Malajanov, Nicholas Isabel, Olaf Mueller Michaels, Pablo Davila, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passon, and Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Eckert, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Queenside Management Limited in Switzerland, Randall Montgomery, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Richard Hallenbach, Richard McCormick, Richard Tucker, Robert Callahan, Robert Turner, Robert Wall, Robert Wilson, Rory Coleman, Ryan Bird, Samson Teaches Chess, Satyajit Malugu, the Say Chess YouTube channel and publishing empire, Scott McKinnon, Scott Rose, Sean Krauss, Sebastian Finsterwater, Sergey Makagon, Seth Ruzica, Seth Will, Sean Tracy, Silver Knights in Richmond, Simon Schmidt, Stefan Roller, Stephen Miller and Tom George, WGM Tatia Vabrahamian, Terry King, Thomas Brown, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, FM Timothy Wall, Tobiah Rex, Tom Edsel, Tommy Farron, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Victor Beauchamp, William Brock, William Peterson, FM Zhao Cheng of Chess1000.com, Zachary Hoskin, and Zhivkor Stoyanov. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Podcast Network.